Hello, this is Ken Kuminski, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 6th, 2025 issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first article, an emboldened Mamdani sheds conciliatory tone. Fresh from a stunning victory, Zohran Mamdani, the mayor-elect, said in an interview that his supporters wanted a politics of consistency and aggressive action, including on taxing the rich. By Emma G. Fitzsimmons. A newly empowered Zohran Mamdani on Wednesday vowed to use his convincing victory in the New York City mayor's race as a mandate to push an ambitious progressive agenda past potential obstacles, from billionaire antagonists to Albany bureaucracy. In a shift from the mollifying tone he had used for months, Mr. Mamdani made clear that while he would govern for all New Yorkers, he was determined to deliver for those who had been agitating for structural change. I'm also looking to be clear about the mandate that we won over the course of this election, and it is a mandate to deliver on the agenda that we ran, he said in a phone interview on Wednesday afternoon after a celebratory lunch with his progressive ally, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. The shift in tone was most striking when it came to his plan to raise taxes on wealthy. In recent weeks, Mr. Mamdani had conveyed an openness to finding creative ways to pay for his signature policy initiative, universal child care, indicating that he was not necessarily set on raising taxes. There was plenty of revenue in the existing budget, he suggested. On Wednesday, Mr. Mamdani said his call to tax the wealthy was also about fairness. He said that New Yorkers who had voted for him were eager for billionaires to pay more taxes. On Monday, the day before the election, droves of Mr. Mamdani's supporters marched with him over the Brooklyn Bridge at sunrise, chanting, "Tax the rich." My supporters and our movement are hungry for a politics of consistency, a politics that actually focuses on the needs of working people, Mr. Mamdani said. I think our tax system is an example of the many ways in which working people have been betrayed. But the mayor-elect's support for tax increases could put him at odds with Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat whose endorsement in September was significant as Mr. Mamdani sought to consolidate Democratic support. Ms. Hochul, a moderate Democrat who is running for re-election next year, has strongly opposed any tax increases. The interview on Wednesday echoed Mr. Mamdani's fiery victory speech on Tuesday evening, which took a more confrontational and at times boastful tone. The address was criticized by some observers as a character switch from his more congenial attitude during the campaign. Mr. Mamdani said his tone was intentional. He was seeking to be bold, he said, and to show that the status quo was not acceptable. His confidence is understandable. He is the first New York City mayoral candidate since John V. Lindsay in 1969 to win over 1 million votes, motivating first-time voters and generating enthusiasm that many of his supporters compared to Barack Obama's presidential victory in 2008. After securing an upset victory in the June Democratic primary over his main rival, former Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, and the business titans and power brokers backing him, Mr. Mamdani beat Mr. Cuomo again in the general election. In his victory speech, Mr. Mamdani dismissed the former governor, saying, "Let tonight be the final time I utter his name." And he warned President Trump, "To get to any of us, you will have to get through all of us." After a campaign marked by attacks over his Muslim faith, his youth, and his left-leaning politics, Mr. Mamdani was defiant. I refuse to apologize for any of this. Mr. Mamdani said on Wednesday that he had not yet asked for a meeting with Mr. Trump, but that he was considering doing so before he takes office. I'm looking forward to speaking with the president about how to serve New Yorkers and tackle the cost of living crisis that he ran on addressing, he said. Mr. Mamdani said he would move quickly to fortify the city against threats from the White House, strategizing with advisors and moving to hire 200 city lawyers to be ready to fight the Trump administration in court. I'm looking forward to the work that we will do over these next 57 days to not only deliver on our agenda, but also to start to protect New Yorkers with the least from the man with the most power in this country, he said. The mayor-elect seemed both exhilarated and exhausted, having slept little before returning to a frenetic schedule of interviews and a news conference to announce his transition team. Given the demands of the job, mayors often seek an outlet to escape the pressure. Michael R. Bloomberg took frequent trips to Bermuda. Bill de Blasio spent leisurely mornings at his favorite gym in Park Slope. The outgoing mayor, Eric Adams, was fond of visiting exclusive nightclubs like Zero Bond. Asked if there was anything he would keep from his life before becoming mayor, even if it might get him into trouble, Mr. Mamdani laughed and mentioned his favorite caffeinated beverage. I will continue to drink Adeni Kai, he said. I'm just not sure where I'll be doing it. And continuing along the same lines, Wall Street laments Mamdani's victory and plots its next move, by Lauren Hirsch. Wall Street financiers greeted the news of Zoran Mamdani's election as mayor of New York City with a mix of trepidation and pragmatism. In interviews, many described the election result on Tuesday as a threat to their business interests, but vowed to work with the new mayor. Others reacted to his ascendancy in more visceral terms, lamenting the victory of a democratic socialist who supports higher taxes and has expressed anti-Israel views. Mr. Mamdani's resounding victory showed that, in this election at least, the city's business elites were not calling the shots. New York City's business leaders spent more than $25 million on efforts to defeat Mr. Mamdani. Undaunted, some of them are already thinking about how they could blunt his most liberal initiatives, turning their attention to Albany, which has the power to block many of his proposals, like raising corporate taxes. In the meantime, some said they would try to make things work. When you're on the plane, you root for the pilot, said Charles Phillips, a private equity executive who had organized a meeting between Mr. Mamdani and black executives over the summer. The city is resilient and will figure out how to work with him. But others were already looking for an exit. Guys like me are definitely seriously considering making moves, said David Modiano, a managing director at Thales Capital in Manhattan, who said he had already begun shopping for homes outside the city amid Mr. Mamdani's rise. Mr. Modiano, a Jewish immigrant from France, said he was principally worried about Mr. Mamdani's enthusiastically pro-Palestinian views and, to a lesser degree, the prospect of higher taxes and rising crime. On a practical level, the business community is not only nervous about whether Mr. Mamdani will raise tax rates, they are wary, too, about the city's relationship with President Trump, whose federal government controls a little more than 6% of the New York City budget, and who threw his support behind Andrew M. Cuomo, who was running as an independent. Ever since Mr. Mamdani won the Democratic primary in June, the city's business leaders have expressed concern about how his proposals would affect safety on city streets, as well as the practicalities of many of his campaign promises, like freezing rents for the city's 1 million rent-regulated apartments. If anything, though, Wall Street is pragmatic, and many of its top leaders say they will look for ways to open a dialogue with Mr. Mamdani and shape his policies. For some, those efforts started in the weeks leading to the election, as Mr. Mamdani's victory became evidently more probable. I don't know how you can sit out on the sidelines and pout. Are you going to move? I don't know. I'm not, said Bess Friedman, the chief executive of Brown Harris Stevens, a real estate service firm. I'm certainly going to stay here and try to make the best of it. Ms. Friedman's optimism, she acknowledged, was not infinite. Of particular importance to her is keeping the police commissioner, Jessica Titch, in the new administration. Mr. Mamdani has suggested he plans to do so, even as he also proposed expanding alternatives to traditional policing, such as deploying teams of mental health professionals to certain emergencies. If he keeps Titch in place and she stays, and the police feel empowered to do the jobs that they need to do, and he works with everyone, the city will survive, Ms. Friedman said. But if he doesn't, and he starts to loosen the tools of law enforcement, and people feel unsafe, and quality of life goes down, and then it's a new discussion for all of us. One top private equity firm has already been running the numbers to understand the financial impact to its business posed by the incoming mayor's policies, an executive said. Mr. Mamdani wants to raise the maximum corporate tax rate to 11.5% from 7.2% and put in place a 2% tax on those who make more than $1 million. The firm was already looking to move executives to cities like Dallas, Nashville, Tampa, Florida, and Charleston, South Carolina, building on a trend of transplanting workers as the cost of doing in business in the city rises. Those plans could now accelerate, that person said. Ed Schuyler, a senior executive at Citigroup, said that even before the election, New York's competitiveness had been in decline. He said Mr. Mamdani would need to figure out how to reconcile his affordability agenda with the need to reverse that trend so companies and their people feel confident in the city's direction. A council of Florida business leaders put out a statement Wednesday morning trying to court New York executives by promoting the state's pro-growth environment and a commitment to opportunity. I think a lot of business leaders are going to ask themselves where they can be successful considering the new laws and policies they may come up against, said Stephen Ross, the billionaire developer who stepped down from New York-based Related in 2024 and began focusing on building out Palm Beach, Florida. One idea that has already been floated among Wall Street donors, including some Democrats, is supporting a potential run for New York governor by Representative Elise Stefanik, a Republican ally of Mr. Trump. Three people familiar with those conversations said, "The governor holds significant control over New York City's fiscal matters, which these donors see as an important check on Mr. Mamdani." Some of these donors were disappointed that Governor Kathy Hochul endorsed Mr. Mamdani, and they liked Ms. Stefanik's aggressive critique of the way universities handled anti-Semitism and campus protests over the war in Gaza. They also hoped that Ms. Stefanik's ties with Mr. Trump could ease relations between the president and the city. But even some of Mr. Mamdani's most virulent critics were looking to make inroads with their new mayor on Tuesday night. "Congrats on the win," the hedge fund manager, William Ackman, posted on X. "Now you have a big responsibility. If I can help New York City, just let me know what I can do." And as a reminder, you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time is 15 minutes past the hour. Next, from the international section, What to Know About the Louvre Heist Investigation by Ségolène Le Stradic. Four thieves are believed to have been directly involved in the headline-making heist at the Louvre last month. The police have now nabbed three of the four, two of whom they believe snatched the jewelry, and one of the two whom they think was waiting outside the museum with motor scooters used in the getaway. The $100 million of iconic jewelry that was taken, however, is still missing. The burglary happened on October 19th, when two of the thieves cut through a window on the second floor of the museum and pulled jewelry out of two glass cases in the Apollo Gallery on that floor, according to the authorities. They say the thieves left the same way they got in, using an electrical ladder mounted on a truck, and then escaped on high-powered motor scooters with the two accomplices waiting for them outside. The brisk theft in less than 10 minutes happened in broad daylight with visitors and museum attendants initially present in the gallery. The brazenness shocked France and the world. Here's what to know about the robbery and the ongoing investigation. How many suspects have been charged and how were they caught? So far, four people have been charged by the Paris prosecutor overseeing the Louvre robbery investigation. Three of them are suspected of having directly robbed the museum and have been charged with theft by an organized gang. That means one other person, whom the police believe to be centrally involved, remains at large. The fourth person who is in custody is a woman, the partner of one of the three suspects being held. She was charged with complicity in the crime. All four were also charged with criminal conspiracy. DNA samples found at the crime scene were instrumental in the arrests. Two of those suspects were arrested a little more than a week ago. They are believed to be the ones who broke into the museum. One of them, an Algerian native, was taken at Paris Charles de Gaulle Airport as he was about to leave for Algeria on a one-way ticket. The other, a French native, was arrested near his home in Albertville's Paris suburb. They partially admitted to the crime during their custody hearings. Laure Boucau, the prosecutor, said at a news conference last week. On Wednesday night, the police arrested five more people suspected of being involved in the heist. Three were released, but the two other were charged. One is a 37-year-old man who the authorities say is one of the accomplices in the getaway. The other is the woman who the authorities say is his partner. In an interview with the radio station France Info on Sunday morning, Mrs. Bacau said that the police had found significant DNA traces of the man, but that those of his girlfriend could amount to transfer DNA. DNA deposited on someone or something that was at the scene. Further investigation will determine whether she was actually involved in the crime, Mrs. Bacau said. The woman and her partner both denied involvement, according to the prosecutor's office. The three men in custody already had criminal records for thefts and traffic violations, which is why their DNA was in a national database. What more do we know about the four suspects? The Paris prosecutor overseeing the case has not named any of the suspects in custody, but has provided some information about their backgrounds. The authorities do not believe they were part of a high-level criminal gang, the prosecutor said. One of the two suspects believed to have broken into the museum is the Algerian native, 34, who has been living in France for the past 15 years. He has worked as a garbage collector and delivery driver, according to the authorities, and he had already been convicted once for theft, as well as for other minor offenses, mainly related to traffic violations. The other accused of breaking in, the French native, 39, who was arrested near his home in Aubervilliers, worked as a deliverer and driver in the past, authorities said. There are 15 entries on his criminal record, including two for thefts, the prosecutor said. During his custody hearing in the Louvre case, he acknowledged that one of those thefts involved ramming a car into an ATM. Diallo Al-Shaman, a lawyer for one of those suspects, neither of whom has been named, said in a text message that she had no comment. Reda Gilazzi, one of the two lawyers for the other suspect, said he hoped the case would be handled with the utmost serenity despite the media exposure. The male member of the couple now in custody has 11 entries on his criminal record, the prosecutor said, out of which 10 relate to thefts. The male half of the couple and the 39-year-old suspect appear to know each other. They were both found guilty in a theft case in 2015, Ms. Bacow said. What were the security failures at the Louvre? The museum's crucial flaw was a dearth of perimeter cameras. The head of the museum, Lorenz Descartes, admitted during a hearing at the French Senate several days after the heist. She added that outdoor cameras were very old and scarce. A New York Times reporter recently counted about 25 cameras on the museum's perimeter and only five on the outer walls. There was a camera on the facade of the Apollo Gallery, but it was pointed in the opposite direction of the window where the thieves entered, Ms. Descartes said. The British Museum, though its perimeter is much smaller than that of the Louvre, has several dozen outdoor cameras. In another Senate hearing on Wednesday, Vincent Enroux, head of the Paris Police Crime Prevention Service, said that one of the force's seven street cameras around the museum captured the thieves' arrival, but that no one noticed anything until they received alerts. Laurent Nunez, the French interior minister, told La Parisienne, a French newspaper, on Saturday, it is impossible to station a police officer behind each of the more than 4,000 cameras currently in operation in Paris. What did the burglars steal? The burglars took eight precious pieces of jewelry, including a sapphire tiara, necklace and matching earrings, an emerald necklace and its matching earrings, and a tiara and a brooch worn by Empress Eugenie, wife of Napoleon III. But they dropped a ninth item, which the authorities recovered later, Empress Eugenie's crown, which featured more than 2,000 diamonds and 56 emeralds. The thieves deformed the crown, flattening it as they pulled it from the case. Olivier Gabet, head of the Louvre's art pieces department, told the French daily Le Monde. But though a few small diamonds and one of its eight gold eagles were missing, Mr. Gabet said he was confident that the crown could be restored. It will never be in its original condition, but it will be very close and will, of course, retain its full symbolic value, he said. With the next article, we'll switch to Russia. Bookstores on edge as Kremlin sets sights on policing books. By Ivan Nechpurenko. A bookstore in central St. Petersburg, once a tiny Soviet relic, grew into one of the city's cultural landmarks in just a few years. It expanded to 12 times its former size, adding two coffee shops, a souvenir department, and a publishing program. The store, Podpisny Izdania, also developed a distinct identity and cachet as a refuge of ideas in an increasingly tightly controlled Russia. Its tote bags, emblazoned with witty slogans, let its fans recognize one another around the world. The store was even featured in the 2023 book, 150 Bookstores You Need to Visit Before You Die. The whole city is a fan of this place, said Rinat Umyarov, 36, a local entrepreneur. It is tangible proof that my generation not only lived in this city, but also created something. But that very success has become a problem since the invasion of Ukraine in 2022. The Kremlin has repeatedly curtailed liberties in the arts and in speech that had been taken for granted. This year, especially, the government turned its sights on books. In May, law enforcement officials arrested three staff members of Popcorn Books and Individium, two progressive publishing houses, charging them with extremism for books about the LGBTQ movement. In July, a court fined Philanster, a popular bookstore in Moscow, and investigators have sifted through the shelves of others around the country. Podpisny Izdania was fined in May for selling three books, Against Interpretation and On Women by Susan Sontag, and Everybody by Olivia Lang. Although the titles were not banned, they contained traces of propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations, Russian investigators said. Literature has always played an outsized, often uneasy role in Russian public life, alternatively hailed and suppressed by those in power. Tsar Nicholas I rehabilitated Alexander Pushkin, Russia's preeminent poet, from internal exile, but told Pushkin that he would be the writer's personal censor. Joseph Stalin phoned Boris Pasternak, who later ran afoul of Soviet authorities, to ask his opinion of another poet, Osip Mandelstam. Unlike the robust centralized censorship apparatus of imperial and Soviet times, publishers and sellers in modern Russia face an evolving, opaque, and inconsistently enforced set of rules. The government has imposed a series of new bans on material, ranging from LGBTQ topics to drugs to a loosely defined Satanist movement. Publishers have faced a difficult dilemma. Either stop offering books that the Kremlin dislikes, clandestinely cut the risky parts, or openly redact them to show readers that something was censored. Many chose the last option, covering potentially problematic lines with thick black or gray ink. Their peers abroad criticized that approach, but in Russia it was seen as a form of protest. It was a political demonstration, said Pyotr, an editor at a Russian publishing house. He requested that his surname be withheld because his employer did not authorize him to speak publicly. It doesn't let people forget that there is a problem. Until recently, Podpisny Izdania, the name means subscription publication, was also open about censorship. Books by authors labeled foreign agents by the Russian state were sold in plastic packaging, with a note of apology on the cover. Now the store has had to remove those books from its shelves. Mikhail S. Ivanov, 38, whose grandmother once ran the store, took Podpisny Izdania over more than a dozen years ago and directed its metamorphosis. In 2023, Mr. Ivanov, who declined to be interviewed for this article, told a popular Russian YouTuber, "People read to understand what is going on and to forget about what is going on." Walking into independent bookstores, it's clear what is on the minds of patrons. Books grappling with difficult histories like Sebastian Hafner's Defying Hitler, a memoir, and Nikolai Eppel's An Inconvenient Past, the memory of state crimes in Russia and other countries, are shown prominently and have topped the bestseller lists in recent years. Vladimir Karatonov, who works at Freedom Letters, a publisher that mostly operates from outside Russia, said of such books, "Even if Germany is written on them, they describe the situation outside the walls of that bookstore." In St. Petersburg, the hometown to Fyodor Dostoevsky and Vladimir Nabokov, bookstores have long served as community centers. people would step into bookstores as if they were anchors of their familiar lives, places that offered an unquestionable sense of safety, said Maxim Mamlaga, a book critic who runs a blog about independent bookshops. Yevgenia Kudryashova, 33, a graphic designer, said that for her, Pobsinye Izdania was an excellent illustration that you should dream big, have faith in yourself, your ideas and power. She added that she went there to buy books for her daughter and that popping in has become part of our family traditions. The city has a bookstore for any taste. One has a reputation as a haven for activists. One is dedicated to books from Asia, and another is popular with film buffs. They are concentrated around the central Litteni district, where many writers have lived and streets bear their names. We live in a special city, said Lyubov Belyatskaya, a founder of Everyone is Free, one of the first independent bookstores in the city, and we worked very hard to develop that culture. Ms. Belyatskaya introduced and promoted the idea of a literary quarter of St. Petersburg. She has compiled a map of more than 180 independent Russian language bookstores around the country and beyond. 2 days before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, she and two colleagues cut out and glued Peace to the World, an old Soviet slogan, to a store window. For about a year, it hung there, offering rare solace to the anti-war crowd. She said that some passersby thanked her for the gesture, but it also enraged pro-war nationalists. Someone shot through the window. The police encouraged Ms. Belyatskaya to remove the slogan. In the Soviet Union, only books explicitly approved by the state could be obtained legally. The possession of any others was dangerous. People passed banned books among friends, sometimes to read over a single night. Today, determined readers in Russia can get any books they want. In coffee shops, people are openly reading Summer in a Pioneer Tie, a lyrical novel about two male teenagers discovering their sexuality in a summer camp. The book became a sensation, selling more than 250,000 copies before the government effectively banned it and declared the authors foreign agents. But people continue to find ways to buy it online. Some publishers and bookstore owners said the Soviet system would be simpler. Preliminary censorship would mean rules of the game are clear, Mr. Mamlaga said. Right now, we're all playing Minesweeper when you don't understand what is forbidden and what is not. Russian law technically does not prohibit the sale of books by foreign agents, but since September, many stores have stopped selling them because the law now prohibits such individuals from engaging in educational activities, which can include publishing. This is the fundamental difference because we now have the entire array of uncensored literature, which is now being retroactively regulated, said Yelena Nescheret, manager of the bookstore Voves Golos and the author of Tales of a Bookseller about the profession in modern Russia. Exmo AST, Russia's biggest publisher, now spends millions of dollars yearly and uses AI to avoid printing banned material. Recently, it redacted more than 15% of Roberto Carnero's essays on the gay Italian filmmaker and writer Pier Paolo Pasolini, making some pages look like heavily classified documents. In footnotes, the publisher said the text was redacted to comply with Russian law that prohibits propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations. And in a statement, it explained that its decision was the more honest choice than simply cutting out paragraphs as if they had never existed. The book becomes an artifact of the era, the publisher said. As a reminder, you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time is now 35 minutes past the hour. And now from the opinion page, an essay by Ron Suskind, The Tragedy of Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney is now gone, but we will be living with his legacy for a long time to come. He wrote a playbook of how to exercise executive authority beyond constitutional boundaries and the rule of law. Donald Trump has added pages and is working on a sequel. It was Vice President Cheney guiding his under-experienced boss, George W. Bush, who brought unitary executive theory into view, operating out of a parallel executive office, staffed with people loyal to Mr. Cheney directly. He unleashed the war on terror, justifying brutal new tactics, an ill-conceived invasion, and a system of mass domestic surveillance. He declared his priorities to be national emergencies, obviating the need to work within the structures of democratic power. He went after those, Colin Powell, Christine Todd Whitman, Paul O'Neill, who stood in his path, and he prioritized the bank accounts of the wealthy by supporting tax cuts in wartime against the strongest of warnings. Disastrous as all those actions were, Mr. Trump has undertaken even more significant expansions of power and illegality, often under even more dubious claims of emergency. Basically, it's the war on terror model without the war. Mr. Cheney made it possible. The two men couldn't have been more different in manner and method. Mr. Cheney favored careful planning with an eye to the long game. Mr. Trump insistently operates on instinct. Mr. Cheney, in the march to war, took pains to help cook up credible seeming evidence. Mr. Trump has no need for evidence. Whatever he posts on Truth Social is his new reality. Mr. Cheney, cynic though he was, honored the dictates of the electorate. Mr. Trump, of course, did so only when he won. After the January 6th Capitol incursion, Mr. Cheney and his daughter Liz became fierce and vocal critics of Mr. Trump. Mr. Cheney felt so strongly about the danger of a second Trump term that he abandoned the party he had served his whole life and endorsed Kamala Harris instead. It was a remarkable development for a man who had always played his cards so close to his vest, always positioning himself as a silent power. By then, however, it was too late. The people he hoped to reach were suspicious of anyone who warned about presidential power or lectured about democratic norms. Mr. Cheney had done as much as anyone in history to undermine America's trust in their institutions and leaders, including Mr. Cheney himself. A false case for war will do that. So will the worst financial crash in 80 years, whose consequences middle and working class Americans were left to suffer unblunted. Many of them went on to join Mr. Trump's army of grievance and anger. The full story started decades earlier. Mr. Cheney was a White House aide under Richard Nixon, chief of staff for Gerald Ford, defense secretary under George H.W. Bush during the 1991 war in Iraq, and the most experienced man in the room in the months after the September 11th attacks. Fresh off a briefing about Qaeda leaders looking for fissile materials to build a bomb, Mr. Cheney uttered what would come to be known as his 1% doctrine. If there's a 1% chance of terrorists getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction, we need to treat it as a certainty. This low probability absolutism became a guiding doctrine of U.S. foreign policy. It has cost blood and treasure in staggering amounts. Before the war started, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney were informed that Saddam Hussein might not, in fact, have weapons of mass destruction. They saw no reason to inform the public. Once Baghdad fell, what would it matter? For those who tried to tell the truth, the consequences were swift. When Ambassador Joseph Wilson undercut some of the administration's justifications for going to war, Mr. Wilson's wife was outed as an undercover CIA officer. And when Mr. Cheney's top aide, Louis Libby, was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice in relation to that outing, Mr. Cheney pressed the president to pardon him, barking, "You are leaving a good man wounded on the field of battle." Mr. Bush held his ground, but Mr. Trump has since obliged. As Mr. Trump bombs boats that may or may not be transporting drugs, concocts a pretext to invade Venezuela, constructs loyalty tests, and viciously punishes those who fail them, and declares vague emergencies and wars to justify his own partisan political ends, he should pause to thank the man who showed America how it could be done. For all his belatedly discovered democratic principles, Mr. Cheney helped to create the world that Mr. Trump inhabits. The contempt he showed for any constraints on his power paved the way for Mr. Trump, and the contempt he now shows for everything but his own naked interest. And now let's switch to the arts section. How the cop show Barney Miller made gay TV history 50 years ago. By Eric Pippenberg. A half century ago, ABC's Barney Miller, a sitcom about seen-it-all cops and kitchen sink criminals at a precinct in Manhattan's West Village, aired an episode that began like any other. Detective Ron Harris, Ron Glass, got a call about a man threatening to jump off the Washington Arch. The payroll department thought Detective Phil Fish, Abe Vigoda, was dead. Captain Barney Miller, Hal Linden, kept everybody in check. Then a quippy gay couple named Marty and Daryl, played by the actors Jack DeLeon and Ray Stewart, swished in and made history as one of the first openly gay couples in mainstream American television. Yet 50 years after it aired, Discovery, as the second season episode was called, is largely forgotten for its important place in the record of queer representation on TV. Stewart thinks a neat gift for his 94th birthday next year would be to get some overdue credit for being years ahead on the homosexual thing, as he put it. "I didn't realize how innovative the episode was," he said over the phone from home in his native San Benito, Texas. "We really were the Wright brothers in a sense." Discovery, which debuted on October 30th, 1975, was a notable coming out. For many TV viewers, Marty and Daryl may have been the first openly gay couple, fictional or otherwise, that they had ever seen or heard. Marty introduces Daryl as his friend, but come on. It was Marty's third appearance on the show. He was in 8 episodes overall. And he and Daryl also appeared together in several later episodes, including in the series finale. This made Marty one of American television's first recurring gay characters, and the two of them one of TV's first recurring same-sex couples. The show also featured a gay cop character. Gay characters had appeared on television before. Many were villains, like the killer lesbians in the 1974 Flowers of Evil episode of Police Woman. Others were treated more sympathetically. In a 1971 episode of All in the Family, the curmudgeonly Archie Bunker, Carol O'Connor, learns that his strapping bachelor friend Steve, Philip Carey, is gay, a model for future coming-out episodes. In 1973, Lois Nettleton played a happy, smiling lesbian psychiatrist in the CBS drama Medical Center. There were gay characters in The Corner Bar, 1972-73, and Hot L Baltimore, 1975, but those shows were flops. Barney Miller was not. It ran 8 seasons and won 3 Emmys. You can stream it on Tubi. Discovery also stands out for why Marty and Daryl went to the cops in the first place, to report that Daryl had been shaken down by a man impersonating a police officer, a so-called fruit hustle, to borrow a phrase from the queer television historian Matt Baume. It was no fiction. At the time the episode aired, queer people were often targets of extortion and other forms of violence in the West Village, home of the Stonewall Inn and a center of New York gay life and activism. That Marty and Daryl were taken seriously by the police, at least make-believe TV cops, whom Marty calls his friends, was a testament to the efforts of Danny Arnold, the former Marine who created Barney Miller. He tried to make the show a social mirror and a corrective, akin to what Norman Lear did in his hit sitcoms, All in the Family and The Jeffersons. Stephen Capsudo, the author of the book Alternate Channels, Queer Images on 20th Century TV, said that by the second season, the writers of Discovery, Arnold, Tom Reeder, and Chris Hayward, were used to being nagged by ABC censors over content related to sex and sexuality, especially during the so-called family hour, a period between 7 and 9 p.m. The networks considered any acknowledgement that gay people existed as talking about sex, Capsudo said. Even using the word gay made the networks nervous. Was the studio audience laughing at Marty and Daryl rather than with them? Sure. Gays lived in the shadows. Sodomy laws were on the books, and these two particular queens were flamboyantly costumed in a baby blue leisure suit jacket, Marty, and a cranberry ombre cardigan, Daryl. According to Arnold, network executives also worried early on that the swishy Marty might offend gay viewers, Capsudo writes. Many of those viewers were already miffed about other series that had treated homosexuality as a sickness, including the drama Marcus Welby, M.D. But Arnold wasn't one to back down from controversial topics, and the raucous applause received by the characters as they walked on set suggested that the studio audience, at least, was a relatively open-minded one. In Jeffrey Cowan's 1980 book, See No Evil, The Backstage Battle Over Sex and Violence on Television, Arnold is quoted as saying in a 1975 news conference that it would be a tremendous disservice to young people if we keep telling them that life is the Brady Bunch. It's really our job to tell them that life has to do with issues, has to do with problems, has to do with sex, has to do with a lot of things that they're going to come into contact with when they get out into the world, he continued. For Stewart, Daryl was a mixed blessing. Delon died in 2006. Playing Daryl led to more work after Barney Miller went off the air in 1982, including on Dallas and Days of Our Lives. I dreamed of being an actor and I did it, he said. I have no regrets about that. I never became a star, but I became good at it. Yet he found himself being typecast. You once play a jeweler, casting directors say, oh, a jeweler, that's Ray, he said. He left television in the early 1990s. These days, Stewart acts in and directs shows in nearby Brownsville, Texas, and South Padre Island, a return to his stage roots on Broadway. Although he played a pioneering gay character, Stewart kept his sexuality private. He said he never felt the need for a partner or to come out. That has changed. In my old age, I've realized that I'm basically gay, he said. In Daryl and Barney Miller, he found not just a paycheck, but a purpose. It's one of the proudest moments, he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time is about 49 minutes past the hour. From the Critics' Notebook, music to mourn Ukraine in World War II returns with fresh urgency. By Karina de Cheka Wolheim. In 1943, the Ukrainian-born composer Thomas de Hartmann wrote a violin concerto that seemed to contain an exile's heartbreak over the destruction of his homeland in World War II. He dedicated it to Albert Bloch, a Jewish violinist living in hiding in the south of France. De Hartmann had fled Russia with his wife, Olga, years earlier as part of the inner circle surrounding George Ivanovich Gurdjieff, a mystic who placed music and movement at the core of his philosophy. For more than a decade, de Hartmann had served as Gurdjieff's amanuensis, transcribing hymns and chants that the guru had gathered on his travels through the Caucasus and the Middle East. After Gurdjieff abruptly cut ties with many of his followers in 1929, the de Hartmanns took refuge in an abandoned house near Paris that fortuitously had a piano. There, the composer began to find his own voice again. In the violin concerto, he poured both anguish and vitality into a score that would be performed in 1947 and then forgotten, packed away like a refugee's suitcase, heavy with memories of an uncoverable past, until decades later the star violinist Joshua Bell stumbled upon it. "I was immediately struck from the very first note," Bell said in an interview. "I thought, what the heck is this? It was so beautiful and unlike anything else." Now, against the backdrop of another war in Ukraine, Bell has become the concerto's most visible champion. His recent recording with the conductor Dalia Stasevska and the INSO Live Symphony Orchestra reveals a work steeped in archetypal folk melody, driving rhythm, and the wistful harmonies of the late Romanticism. On Thursday, Bell will perform the violin concerto at David Geffen Hall with Stasevska and New York Philharmonic, ahead of performances in Toronto and Boston. Now, North American audiences will have the opportunity to judge Stasevska's claim in a video interview that the piece is as good a concerto as any of the top 10 of the 20th century. De Hartmann was born in 1884 in what is now Ukraine. His family was aristocratic with German roots. A musical prodigy, he studied piano and composition in St. Petersburg, Russia, while also completing military training. In 1908, he traveled to Munich to study with Felix Model, a conductor and former student of Wagner's. Then, at the outbreak of World War I, de Hartmann was called up to serve in his regiment in Russia. After the 1917 revolution, he fled the country with his wife Olga, eventually joining Gurdjieff's spiritual circle in Tbilisi, Georgia, and later following the guru to Constantinople, now Istanbul, Berlin, and Paris. For nearly two decades, de Hartmann gave up concert music, devoting himself to Gurdjieff's teaching and composing film scores to help fund Gurdjieff's movement. The violin concerto, completed in 1943, emerged from a period of creative ferment. De Hartmann was not Jewish, but his anguish over the persecution of European Jewry comes through in the concerto's modal turns and hard-on-sleeve laments. At times, he evokes the spirit of klezmer without quoting it outright. Decades of transcribing vernacular tunes from around the world honed his gift for composing a brand of folklore that feels familiar to listeners from different cultures. Bell said that several members of the Oslo Philharmonic during rehearsals told him they heard passages straight out of Norwegian folk music. Bell's recording of the work grew out of his relationship with Stasevska, who was born in Kiev, Ukraine, and raised in Finland. She had already begun exploring overlooked Ukrainian composers when Russia invaded the country in 2022. The war brought fresh urgency to her mission, and when Bell mentioned the De Hartman Concerto to her, she became determined to record it with a Ukrainian orchestra. Conceived with cinematic sweep, the concerto sounds like a projection of De Hartman's grief at the destruction of his birth country. It's almost like the violin is his alter ego, coming back to a war-torn Ukraine and trying to search for lyricism and beauty in the country. It's almost like the violin is his alter ego, coming back to a war-torn Ukraine and trying to search for lyricism and beauty in the country of his childhood that is now completely shattered, Stasievska said. After ghostly chords in the orchestra, the violin enters almost violently with a piercing sound, and a lament comes out. Bell described the opening as one of the most haunting in the repertoire. Every time I hear those first harmonies, I get goosebumps, he said. The violin comes in like a narrator. It feels like the start of the story. The concerto is in four movements. The first weaves folk melodies into a dramatic score that includes belligerent outbursts. The andante is heavy with melancholy. The finale explodes with breathless virtuosity and rough-hewn rhythms that bring to mind Stravinsky and Bartok. It's like he's hearing the dances of his childhood, the melodies of his grandmother that used to sing to him. Stasievska said, there's joy, but also so much pain and sometimes almost militaristic violence. Tucked in between the second and fourth movements is the miniature interlude, Minuet Fantasque, according to De Hartman's widow, Olga. It represents the ghost of a fiddler. She became a tireless champion of her husband's work after his death in Princeton, New Jersey in 1956. Here the orchestra withdraws to soft pizzicati while the violin executes disarmingly simple dances. It's so haunting, Bell said. I can totally see it as the ghost of a violinist roaming the hills. Already poignant, the concerto took on even more meaning in Bell and Stasievska's recording because of the circumstances under which it was made. The project couldn't be done in Lviv, Ukraine, where the orchestra is based, with the frequent air raid alarms that have sent people running for shelter. Instead, the INSO Lviv Orchestra traveled to Warsaw for the recording, which required special government permission for the male players to leave Ukraine during wartime. It was very meaningful for the musicians, Stasievka said. After hundreds of years of oppression, Ukrainians are now going through the very difficult de-imperialization of their minds and history. They are discovering who they are, what their culture is, and what the music is that has been forbidden, destroyed, or not published, she added. So in a way, we are all together on this journey. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 6th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Ken Kuminski. Thank you for listening.